Wendy, Lucianne Walkowitz is in studio with us. People probably know her best as the guitarist for Ditch Club. She's also an astrophysicist and does some work over at the Adler Planetarium as an astronomer.
Welcome back, Lucianne.
Thanks for having me.
You know, we wanted to have you, I can't remember, I think it was last Tech Tuesday, we were talking to Ashley Esqueda from CNET, and there was a story she was going to cover, and I wanted to save it for you because I was blown away by it. The International Space Station has an inflatable room.
Yes, it does. It's called the Bigelow Expandable. Oh, and now I'm going to forget what the A and the M stand for. It's it's called BEAM, and it's basically a room that they attach to the International Space Station and then inflate it over the
like a
bouncy
house.
Yeah, that's
God,
it.
How old are we?
Astronauts love bouncy houses.
Everybody loves bouncy
sure.
houses. It's scientifically proven.
What do they do in this room, this inflatable room?
Well, you know, it's kind of funny, actually. The reason that this was installed is that they're trying to test having these inflatable habitats because it gives you more bang for your buck, basically. Mm-hmm. If you can launch something that you then inflate, it weighs less and then you get more room.
Oh.
However, this is the first time this has been done, so it's really kind of a test module, and the astronauts aren't living in there, really. They're just sort of going in and doing tests on it. So it's a little bit like if you installed like an addition on your home,
yeah.
and your neighbors came over and they're like, oh, that's great. You guys hang out in there all the time. And you're like, we go in there like 6 to 7 times per year.
Right, that's it.
But wouldn't you be scared? This is in space, people, and this is the Bigelow Expandable Activity Module.
Thank you.
You can thank Kevin. He looked that up. You're very quick with the Google. Wouldn't you be scared, though? This is space. This is like just an inflatable room. Aren't you going to be scared it's going to pop?
Well, I think that's why they're being very cautious and not having people live in it yet. Obviously, they've tested it a lot on the ground. And, you know, there are a lot of things that are that would seem like they're relatively fragile that,
right.
you know, you can actually make very strong, like, fabrics and stuff like that. So, you know, presumably the material has been tested extensively on the ground before being installed on the International Space Station.
And they send up a patch kit. Right? I hope. Small patch kit, right? Okay, good.
It just works with your typical bike tools.
Right. It's easy to fix.
Just
good.
A couple tire irons
That's
under there.
That's good. And,
yeah.
That's very good. So eventually, what's is the goal, eventually, if this works out, to do more of this sort of thing?
Yeah, so yeah. Bigelow is a private aerospace industry company in the same way that, like, SpaceX is. SpaceX is a little bit more of, like, a familiar name at this point. Everybody has watched these, like, amazing SpaceX launches and
mm-hmm.
stuff. But Bigelow is another company that is developing equipment and materials for space applications. So you'll see things like this being deployed on the International Space Station, but eventually these are the kinds of things that you might imagine sending to Mars to have like an inflatable habitat that you could live in. Because ultimately, one of the challenging things about going into space is that everything, the weight of everything counts, basically. So the heavier it gets, you know, the more fuel you need, the more expensive it becomes to launch. So
if and the longer the TSA lines.
Yes. That is really
That's
true.
The worst
Space
part.
Does not have pre-check yet.
You know, you reminded me of something like when you go to Mars, and I know that that's the next step, and we want to see if it's inhabited by whomever. I saw something on Groupon. I told you about this, and it is crazy. You can buy an acre of land on Mars for $5. I know. So you're the person that we need to talk to about this, because how does that work? You're not getting an acre. And what happens when we do make it to Mars and start building inflatable activity modules? What is there going to be, like, property owned by such and such? Isn't that crazy?
I kind of wonder whether Groupon knows that somebody is trying to sell acreage Mars.
Right.
That's what surprised me, because
yeah.
Groupon keeps track of all these things.
Well, you know, it's a little. It reminds me a little bit of the name of star.
I have
thing.
There's a Wendy Snyder star out there.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Wendy.
I didn't pay for it.
Well, the whoever bought
star
Wendy
Registry.
A star. Please
You've
cover
wasted your
ears. Your
money, right?
There is no international. Well, there is an International Star Registry. It distributes pieces of paper that tell you that you own a star when you do not.
I know it's framed.
You know, I'm sorry, Wendy. You're
Wendy has been paying property taxes the last couple of years. That's a waste of money,
too. I know, and they've gone up.
A lot.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. Yeah. Yeah, you cannot buy acreage on Mars at the moment.
Isn't that crazy?
It's not owned by anyone. There are treaties in space that people do not own.
Space treaties?
Yes.
Yeah, there's space treaties.
Wow, you knew that?
Yeah, there's space treaties.
Yeah, there's a whole branch of policy that deals with policy in space.
Yeah.
And so, you can't buy... Like acreage on the moon, for example.
Yes.
Because
there's a man up there who owns all the property, the man on the moon.
Yes. That and a cheese shop.
When we eventually do send people to Mars, now I only know this from movies because it hasn't happened yet, but in movies, when astronauts go to Mars, they put them in some sort of a chamber and they make them sleep through the trip because it's so long. Will people be sleeping for months or even years when they go back and forth to Mars? Is that the only way to do it?
I think people will just be... living,
yeah,
doing their sort of daily activities in the same way that people in the International Space Station, when they spend a long time up there, they're doing various experiments and taking care of the space station itself. And we don't have any way of putting people in controlled coma. Well, I mean, we do occasionally for medical purposes put people in controlled coma,
right.
But that's not something that we really can do in the way that you see it in.
Yeah.
Science fiction movies. And so, the trip to Mars is long, but it's...
Years, right?
Yeah, it's anywhere from, a couple months to a couple years, depending on where things are and how fast you're going. Yeah, and traffic.
It's like driving to Indianapolis. Have you ever driven to Indianapolis? It takes forever. It's the same kind of thing,
construction.
Right?
Construction.
Yeah, it's construction.
Well, and, most of the travel is the TSA lines.
Yeah, it always is.
Have you ever had any desire to go to the International Space Station?
I was thinking about this the other day. I actually did not grow up wanting to be an astronaut. Now, I think if somebody was like, hey, we got an extra spot, you don't have to go through that pesky astronaut training program screening process, you can just go tomorrow, I would say yes.
You would say yes.
But I think when I was very little was when the Challenger explosion happened.
Yeah.
So I think somewhere that must have set up a situation in my brain where I was like, I'm fine here. I'll study it for you.
Right. I get that.
I mean, there are too many risks. Something could totally happen on your way there, on your way back. There still could be some issues while you're there, too.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, think of how many people you want to spend several years locked in a room with.
No one. I'd like to go by myself, and there better be internet, because I want to play Candy Crush Saga.
Right.
That's all I want to do.
Did we talk to you about that astronaut program where they get twins, and they keep one twin here on Earth, and they send the other twin to space? Do you know about this?
Yeah, the Kelly twins.
Yeah, the Kelly twins.
Yeah,
that's them.
Yeah, a couple of underachieving brothers, Mark and Scott.
Right.
One of whom got to stay on Earth, one of whom lived for a year in the International Space Station.
Right.
I think we did maybe touch on it a little bit, that program is essentially to study how people's physiology does in space.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
What were some of the major differences? Wasn't one a different height than when he came back? Did he lose?
Well, I think they're still studying him, so I don't know that there's any bottom line at the moment. But a typical thing that happens when people go to space is that they develop some at least mild osteoporosis, because your bone density has to do with how much impact you experience, and human beings are used to being in Earth-like gravity.
Right.
So part of the reason for studying microgravity environments is to study how your body changes. Now, they usually get that back after you've been in Earth gravity for a while. You take calcium supplements, they build back their bone density. But
isn't your body amazing, though?
Yes.
How it can change. I mean, seriously.
I have long said, as a person who studies the physical sciences and not the biological sciences, that biology is amazing and disgusting.
Yeah, at the same time. How about that?
All right, we have Lucianne Walkowitz in the studio. She's an astrophysicist, Adler astronomer, and this is a great question that I don't think we've ever asked you before. Drew is on the line. Drew, you have a question for Lucianne?
Yeah, I guess. Thanks for taking my call. So just know that a lot of good sci-fi movies and TV shows came out in the last year. I would wonder if Lucianne has a favorite movie or TV that she's seen in the sci-fi category.
Oh, that's a good question. I'm actually a terrible person to ask because I don't watch a lot of sci-fi.
You don't?
No. Yeah, no, everybody expects that I'm very, familiar.
You live it. I mean, you kind of do.
A little bit. I actually really liked Interstellar. I know that's a little bit dated at this point, but I liked Interstellar a lot. I also liked Gravity, but I kind of wish that Gravity was a silent movie.
Oh, really?
If there was no story in Gravity, think I would have been better off.
Yeah.
But I really enjoyed Interstellar, that's about as recent a reference as I can muster.
Well, how about a little bit further back? Are you a Contact fan?
Yeah, actually, I love Contact.
That's the Jodie Foster movie?
Yeah, I really love Contact.
Oh, that was good.
Yeah. Jodie Foster's character in that movie is based on a real astronomer, Jill Tarter, who's the head of the SETI Institute until just recently. Jill's a really amazing astronomer herself, so it's really cool to see her sort of brought to life as this fictional character in Contact. And I really adored Contact. I thought it was a great movie. And I love, like, 2001, which is
fantastic.
Yeah, I'm a big Kubrick fan.
Yeah.
Thank you, Drew.
Great question, Drew. Take care.
All right. Do you, and I don't, you don't have to answer this because it might make people think differently of you. We asked this to Buzz Aldrin, and he said yes. Do you think we have life out there?
I would say I hope so.
That's a great answer.
Well, you know, there is an entire branch of astronomy now that deals with the search for life in the universe and trying to understand life in the universe called astrobiology. So people who come to astrobiology usually come from all kinds of different backgrounds. They can be geologists or, you know, biologists, chemists, astronomers like myself. And, you know, it is actually a legitimate area of study. That it's something that in the next couple of years, as we get better at not just finding planets around other stars, but actually studying like what their atmospheres are made up of, that we might actually be able to detect life on other planets.
But not like, you know, there's not going to be a Bill Leff that's living on Mars or
something. You don't
know
that. There
you might be
is.
In amoeba form.
That's fine.
With a baseball cap.
I'm all right with
it's
that.
It's really weird that little
that would
amoeba would have a little tiny baseball cap. But you don't think there's
adorable.
Human life out there, do you?
Well,
it can't be human because the planets wouldn't allow a human life form. The elements of another planet would be so different, they couldn't be human-like, could they?
Well, that's the thing, actually, is that one of the things that makes astronomy work is that the physics and chemistry of the universe is pretty similar everywhere.
Yeah?
Like, you know, carbon, the periodic table of elements, which I wish people would tell little kids this because I think it's really interesting, the periodic table of elements is basically an ordered list of how common stuff is in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things like hydrogen and helium, which are one and two, most common thing in the universe. And
yeah.
So that's basically a listing of, you know, how common the building blocks of anything are. So carbon is a very common element. It very, like, easily makes very complex molecules, which is why we think that it's involved in the chemistry of life here on Earth. And so it happens to be the thing that, you know, is around for us to build life out of if we were to find it elsewhere. However, you know, think about, like, your ability to communicate with a dolphin.
Right.
Like, dolphins are very intelligent animals.
Yeah.
You know, we don't really have good ways of communicating with other life forms that are here on Earth, but we can see that they're there. You know, obviously we have front row seats to what life is happening on Earth. But we can study, like, how life affects the atmospheres of other planets and be able to find it there. So whether it would be, you know, exactly like humans, well, most life on planet Earth is not exactly like humans.
Right. But just the fact that the oxygen content would be different on another planet, that alone would change your nose, your lungs, almost everything about your respiratory system.
But we haven't found every planet. Couldn't there be a planet out there that...
Well, sure, there could be, and there are so many planets now. We generally accept that there's probably billions of planets within our galaxy alone. We haven't found every single one of them, but the numbers that we've found so far tell us that percentage-wise, they're probably pretty common. Now, that doesn't mean that they're exactly like this one, but it could be that there's another one out there that is very similar. But again, you know, your point is well taken that, you know, we... evolved in response to our environments, and other life forms, even here on Earth, evolve in response to their environments. And so one of the things that astrobiologists do is they study the diversity of life on Earth and why things are the way they are, and all of the places that life can live. And so that's sort of one step that we can make close to home that helps us understand what life might be like elsewhere in space.
We have to take a break. I loved science in high school and junior high and elementary school, and I'm loving it right now because science is cool. It really is. Lucianne Wachowicz, astrophysicist, Adler astronomer, artist, guitarist in Ditch Club, and we will continue. Bill Leff, Wendy Snyder, 720 WGN.
Intergalactic, planetary, planetary, intergalactic, intergalactic, planetary.
These childish texters have to grow up. You know how many Uranus jokes have come over?
Not enough.
I mean,
keep them coming. Keep them coming.
Lucianna Walkowitz in the studio from the Adler Planetarium. She's an astrophysicist. And what's going on? There's a new Adler Sky show.
There is. This is a brand new show called Planet Nine that is about the possible existence of a ninth planet in the very outer reaches of the solar system.
Where would it be located?
Well, that's Uranus.
I'm sorry, next to Uranus.
All right, that's better. That's better.
So it would be located way, way far out, past Pluto, out in what we call the Kuiper Belt.
No, I meant the Adler Planetarium. Where is that located?
Ethan Hawke has just canceled.
I don't blame him. Now, where's Plan 9 from outer
Planet
space located?
Nine.
Planet 9 from outer space. It is from outer space. So that's one of the interesting things, is that there is what we would call circumstantial evidence that there is another planet in the outer portion of the solar system. However, we don't know if it's there because it hasn't been directly detected yet. But it seems like from looking at other what we call dwarf planets, things that are sort of similar to Pluto,
yeah,
that their orbits are being almost herded by gravity. So they orbit in such a way that indicates that there might be something influencing those orbits that we can't see. And one of the ways that it would be possible for this to happen is if there was a large planet that we had not yet discovered in the outer portions of the solar system. So we worked with the two discoverers of this this possible ninth planet. I guess you can't be a discoverer if it's still not actually discovered.
Yeah.
But the two people who reported this evidence, Mike Brown and Constantin Batygin, who are both astronomers at the California Institute of Technology. And Mike worked with us to develop this show, and it's really fantastic, I think, in part because it's very human. A lot of it is, there's some, you know, narration done by Mike himself,
yeah,
who's known as Pluto Killer on Twitter. He's one of the primary discoverers of many of these outer solar system bodies. And, you know, he narrates the process of why Pluto became a dwarf planet instead of being a planet and what makes us think that this Planet Nine might exist. And it's unique in the sense that I feel like when you usually see documentaries about space or you go to other planetaria, what you see is some things that are already known. And this is very much like hot off the presses, you know, scientific discoveries that have been made literally in the past few months.
Uh-huh.
And that it's something that we're still in the process of figuring out. And that's very unusual if you think about it for the topic of a sky show.
Right.
And so I think it's fun in the fact that you're experiencing sort of the cutting edge part of space science that's happening now instead of, you know, like here's a tour of all the things we already know about there.
Good.
Yeah,
much more immediate.
It's really fun. Our visualization experts actually worked a lot with Mike and Constantin when they were developing the paper. And frankly, it was a good example of the role of visualization, because these cool visuals that, you know, you or any visitor to the planetarium would see were also very helpful and informative for Mike and Constantin in developing their paper. You know, the things that they could see sort of in graphs are,
yeah,
much more beautifully realized in the form of making the show. And this came out of a wonderful lecture that Mike gave last year that was funded by the Kavlian Foundation.
Yeah. So. And this is seeable now. If you go to the Adler Planetarium, it's showing right now.
It just opened. It's a really nice compliment to, we have another exhibit that just recently opened in the past couple of months called What is a Planet? That talks, mm-hmm, about Pluto's demotion.
Yeah, because it's now, what is it now?
It's a dwarf planet.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. People get very worked up about Pluto still. It's very, it's an emotional topic.
Yeah.
Isn't that politically incorrect? Don't you have to say diminutive planet or little planet, not a dwarf one?
I think you get to call Pluto whatever you want.
Okay. But
some astronomers are still quite upset that it's not a planet at all anymore.
Geographically challenged? Do we say that? I don't know how you word
size.
It.
Maybe gravitationally challenged?
Maybe, all
right. Yeah,
that seems acceptable.
Is it the size that keeps it from being a planet? It's too tiny?
So it's not really quite massive enough. There are three criteria that you have to pass to be a planet. You have to be in orbit around the sun. You have to be large enough, so massive enough that your gravity has sort of shaped you into more or less a sphere shape.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to have done what's called clearing your orbit, which basically means you have to be the gravitational boss of your neighborhood.
Boy, I've done two out of those three. I'm this close to being a planet.
Yeah, but that's, you know, that and a couple bucks buys a latte bill. Leftopia.
I know. That'd be the name of my planet.
You're welcome. I want some credit.
All right.
I bought some land on it already. For $5
an
acre.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yep.
Always a pleasure to see you. Lucianne Wachowicz, go see Planet 9. It's at the Adler Planetarium now. What's the Adler website?
It's adlerplanetarium.org.
Thank you for stopping by. Always a pleasure.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Thanks, Lucianne. Break. Steve with the news and then more show. Ethan Hawke later on, by the way. Bill and Wendy, WGN.